Hello and welcome to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado, and I'll be your host for this episode, which I am once again recording from my closet in downtown Memphis. Almost a year ago, on my second interview for this podcast, I talked to Howard Phillips Smith about Unveiling the Muse, the Lost History of Gay Carnival in New Orleans. I invited him back here today to tell us about his follow-up book, Southern Decadence in New Orleans. It was co-written with Frank Perez, the president of the LGBT Plus Archives Project of Louisiana, and published by the Louisiana State University Press in 2018. Southern Decadence in New Orleans provides the first comprehensive historical look at the other important event in the LGBTQ calendar of the Crescent City. Howard Phillips Smith, welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies.
Good to be back.
Yes, how and where are you?
I am in Los Angeles at my home, and I'm trying to keep my head together with all of this stuff.
Yeah, we're trying to hang in there. I must tell you that it was bittersweet reading your book during this pandemic. It brought back great memories. I was there for the 2015 Southern Decadence celebration. But I don't know if and when it will happen again or how it will be changed by the current crisis. So therefore, it was bittersweet. We usually start these interviews by asking our guests to introduce themselves. But since we already did that in our previous interviews of you, and folks can check that out, I will leave a link for this interview, for that interview in the blog post for this interview, if for anybody who's interested. So I'll ask you to start by telling us, how did this book come about and what's your connection to this story? I know you attended Southern Decadence a few decades ago.
Yes, when I lived in New Orleans, which was really during the late 70s, early 80s, and I became, a part of the gay community in New Orleans. Southern Decadence was just something that happened every year. No one that I knew gave it a second thought. You know, it's almost Labor Day. It's going to be Southern Decadence. What are you going to wear? What kind of drag are you going to wear? It just, all of a sudden it popped up. It was really hot. It's in the, you know, the hottest part of the summer. And I did attend a couple of early 80s Decadence bar crawls with everybody. But the wonderful thing was you could just figure out where it was during the day. It was always the Sunday before Labor Day. And then if you got tired, you could just bow out. It wasn't like you had to stay, you know, the whole time, the whole day, because it was basically in the early 80s was a barrage on all the straight bars is what the way I remember it. So it was shock, you know, it was visibility, it was shock, it was crazy drag, it was fun, friends. So that's how I knew it. And as I was researching Unveiling the Muse and another project that I was working on, New Orleans history project, I came into contact with someone I knew. I reestablished that contact with Blanche, who was a bartender at the Golden Lantern. The Golden Lantern was the center of Southern Decadence at that time during the 80s. His real name was Ed Norton, and he had moved. This was in the early 2000s, and he had moved back to Alabama. This is where he was from. So through some friends in New Orleans, I got back in contact with him, and we corresponded and talked on the phone for really a couple of years, just really capturing his life in New Orleans and what he had experienced in especially Southern Decadence. So that was really interesting to me to see his perspective, and I just kind of put that aside. And then as I was working on Unveiling the Muse, I became more interested in Southern Decadence as sort of the mirror image of Carnival. It's at the, you know, the other end of the calendar. It's costuming, it's parading. There's some precedence in Carnival for walking clubs and things like that. Because Southern Decadence is really just a costume walking parade throughout the French Quarter. So with that kind of a renewed interest, I read something that really shocked me. The original founders of Southern Decadence were still alive and living in New Orleans, most of them. And what my perception of Decadence was a completely gay event. It was just, you know, let's get in drag, let's parade around the French Quarter, let's have a good time. However, the founders of Southern Decadence were gay, straight, black, and white. There were a very mixed group of friends who started the celebration in 1972. So I got in contact with the founders. They lived on Magazine Street, uptown New Orleans. And on one of my research trips to New Orleans, I visited them, and we really clicked, and I saw the potential for writing about this early history. And it just so happened I had a meeting with Frank Perez that same day in the afternoon. So we were talking, and he was researching John Kennedy Toole in his letters at the time. And we were just talking. I just turned to him and I said, "Frank, would you be interested in collaborating with me on a Southern Decadence project? I think I can write about the first phase of it, the first decade. And then the 80s and 90s, I think I've got that covered as it segued into this gay celebration. I don't really know what's been happening in the last 20 years, but you have your finger on the pulse." He knew a lot, many of the grand marshals of Southern Decadence. This was probably 2015, 2016 that we started talking about this. So I said, "Could you write about the third phase of Decadence when it really exploded?" So that was the last puzzle piece. So we felt that we could put together this book with some, you know, accuracy, historic accuracy. And our goal was to really take a snapshot of Decadence for the book. That was 2016. So we wanted to just talk about everything that was happening with Decadence, the parade itself. And then I was lucky enough to enlist the aid of a young photographer to come and actually embed in the entourages for Southern Decadence and photograph the events. So there was a lot of grants and, you know, cajoling people to donate to plane tickets for people to come to New Orleans. So, and then to put the icing on the cake, one of the founders of Decadence, Robert Laurent, had filmed some of these processions with his Super 8 camera. They were in bad shape. So I again had to get grant money to restore these films, which we've done. And luckily, because of a strong collection of Tulane, the Maureen Block, who is the so-called mother of Southern Decadence, and other people who were interested in Tulane, we approached Tulane to donate all of their physical items and this restored film of the early Decadence to Tulane and establishing the Southern Decadence archive at Tulane, which happened. So that's kind of the broad sweep of the book.
And it's amazing that in the process, right, you created this archive that will be around and folks can check out. That's wonderful.
It was much needed, Isabel. I think as people generate items and photographs and posters for the Decadence, they need to save it and always think about donating. So I think that's happening, hopefully.
That's wonderful. So you, as you mentioned, there is the book has this frame, right? This snapshot of the 2016 celebration. And in that section, we follow the four grand marshals as they prepare and participate in the Sunday big event. We learn about the days of fundraising that lead to the festivities. And I was really impressed by the variety of events, right? We have drag shows and crawfish boils, historical tours, and the Buy a Boy auction. Tell us a bit about this fundraising process. What are they raising funds for? And oh, but first tell folks who might not know it, what is a Grand Marshal?
Well, the Grand Marshal is the king or queen of decadence. They are the ruler of decadence. The Grand Marshal is always selected by a previous Grand Marshal. That's written in stone. That's one of the traditions that cannot be broken. So a Grand Marshal designates his or her successor, and then that person, you know, sometimes there's more than one, but they will get together and decide on the theme of decadence and the charities that they will raise money for. So it's really a big deal in New Orleans, gay community, who is the Grand Marshal, because they are revered and, you know, there's some, you know, they're very respected. And so that's very interesting. But the fundraising thing is really a new development. I would say really in the 2000s, Grand Marshal started raising money for basically AIDS charities, but other things, raising money for the LGBTQ plus Archives Project of Louisiana. I know, you know, I got grants from them directly to fund the book. So it's, you know, to restore the film and everything, as I was talking about. So the fundraising is definitely for charitable agencies like No Age, which is the elderly gay senior housing project. So they're really plugged into benefiting the community.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to ask you earlier, because again, folks listening to this might not know Southern Decadence. Give us a picture of the scope of this thing. How many people attend and the economic impact of the festivities today? Well, at least until last year.
Yeah. For the past, I would say for the past 10 years, it has been a huge, huge deal. 10, 15 years. Hundreds of thousands of It's a worldwide destination now. Hundreds of thousands of primarily gay men come to the city, rent hotel rooms, go to the restaurants, and participate, you know, by viewing the parade on the Sunday. Now, originally, it was just the Sunday walking parade, but now it's a whole week of festivity. So you really need to get to New Orleans a week before the Sunday, and then there's all of these bar-sponsored block parties and different, there's a Friday night drag show. This is a tradition now at the Golden Lantern. So there's the scope of what it is builds up, the momentum builds up with these different events during the week. And then on Sunday is the big parade, which goes through the French Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, economic impact, millions of dollars, millions. Yeah. This is the great statistic that I learned. Carnival is the number one money generator for New Orleans, but there's growing statistical you know, proof that decadence may be the second largest for the city.
Yes, wow,
which is mind blowing.
Yes,
but it's important.
Absolutely, and it's even cooler to see that when we learn as we're going to see how did this thing start, right? But before you tell us how the celebration began here in the book, you discussed the origins, and this is a section I found really interesting, and the meaning of the word decadence, and more specifically, Southern decadence. Can you tell us about that and explain the Tennessee Williams connection? What is Southern decadence?
Southern decadence is a really slippery term because it can be pejorative, it could be nuanced. Decadence in itself is, you know, like, oh, they're ruined, the ruin of something. So, as in my mind, as the South was defeated in the Civil War, there is this odd kind of flavor that people reference about the South going through this ruin, like the plantations are in ruin. And then it's just this sort of march toward ruin and self-indulgence, you know. So that's kind of where people understand it today. And there's all these sort of, it's almost a cliche reference. You go, oh, it's Southern Gothic, it's Southern decadence, it's this, you know, kind of wallowing in amusement, this type of thing. That's one take on it. But another take is, you know, it's this sort of atmosphere that Tennessee Williams plugged into, especially with Streetcar Named Desire, where you have Blanche, who comes from Mississippi, and her family's plantation is in ruin. Again, you have this sense of ruin, and she's come to New Orleans as a last resort, and she, you know, dreams of the time when she went to parties and cotillions, and so it's this kind of longing for this kind of opulent lifestyle, I guess. So many writers have tapped into the Southern decadence thing. So
yeah, I saw. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, does that make sense? I mean, it's a slippery term, but
yeah. With the event, what I felt was this was a critique, but also a camp appropriation of this old South nostalgia, right?
Nostalgia, yeah. The camp. In fact, the person who really named the whole thing the Southern decadence, Robert Laurent, it did use it as sort of a critique in camp. So I think that's a good way to encapsulate it. It's critiquing it, but it's like putting it on display. And, you know, camp can be very monolithic. You know, it's like, oh, this thing is just so great because it's so crazy. Does that make sense?
Yes. So you have a chapter here that traces this metamorphosis of the French Quarter into a tourist destination. And you show the role of gay men in that process. We talked a bit about New Orleans being a gay mecca in the early to mid 20th century in our previous interview. But here you note that while, you know, Southern decadence didn't begin as an uniquely gay event, it was born during a transitional period, both for the gay community and for the French Quarter. Can you explain that transition and tell us what was gay New Orleans like when Southern decadence started? And I'm talking here about the late 60s and early 70s, just to contextualize this.
Well, that's a very interesting time, especially for the French Quarter. I think this is where people started thinking of New Orleans as a tourist destination. Oh, I want to go to New Orleans and spend the weekend, or go taste some of the interesting food there, or, you know, maybe tour the plantation. So all of this kind of propaganda had been promulgated, you know, decades before that, especially during the 50s. But I think people really started coming to New Orleans in the 70s. And the gay scene in New Orleans in the 60s and 70s was very much underground. You had the carnival crews who, you know, were well established at this point, but they were not openly visible to the population of the tourists when they came to town. So this was still kind of under wraps. Now, you did have the gay bars in the French Quarter, the gay and lesbian bars. There were a lot of lesbian bars at this time. So that was another destination for the queer community outside of New Orleans. But that was slowly building up. So it wasn't anything overt at that time. And at the time that Southern decadence had started, there was this core group of people who had really moved back to New Orleans, I think, because guys from Lafayette, from Baton Rouge, even from Chicago and New York. They came back to New Orleans. They were very close friends. And so they started doing, you know, bar hopping and playing cards and that type of thing. So that's kind of how Decadence got started.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as like you, I was surprised to find that in its inception, this was not exactly a gay or a queer event, but it was a celebration that brought together a group of misfits, right, from the product of the 1960s and 70s counterculture, I would say, folks who felt like outcasts. Who were these people and how did they meet the original Decadence?
Well, this was such a surprise, I think, for a lot of people, because 9 times out of 10, when you talk to someone in New Orleans in the gay community, it's like, oh, Decadence is gay. It's always been gay. But that's why this book is so important, I think, because you had this group of friends, like I was saying, and they some of them had met at college in Lafayette, Baton Rouge. It was sort of this end of the hippie culture. They were interested in music and film and that type of thing. And when these friends got together, and there was some of them had another friend that might be good for the group, they would bring them into the group. And they became very very close, is my understanding. And they're all still close today. That's what started all of this. And I guess by chance. Well, let's go to the 1972 to Chicago. This was early in the year when one of their members was graduating from college in Chicago. So a lot of the friends went to Chicago, and some other friends tagged along, and they had such a great time in Chicago that when several of them moved to New Orleans, they just wanted to stay together. So they moved to New Orleans and continued that friendship. And they would get together weekly to play cards or to go to bars in the French Quarter. But they were always this core group of people, and they were very witty and camp and sarcastic and that type of thing. So they really enjoyed just the banter and going out and doing that type of thing in the French Quarter. And so we have that set up already for 1972, when one of the friends, Michael Evers, and his partner, David Randolph. Well, David Randolph had a house in Treme. A lot of gay men would buy houses in Treme and fix them up, that type of thing. So they moved in together in Treme, and David Randolph's father died. He had a business up north, so he had to go take care of that. So Michael Evers said, well, let's all get together. Let's throw a party at Belle Reve, is what they call their house, of course, with the Tennessee Williams connection. So they did. They threw this party, and Robert Laurent did this really great invitation and sent it out to their core friends. And so they got together, and there was a garden out back, and it was very private. So they had, they could, you know, play music and drink and do drugs and that type of thing. So 2 weeks later, Michael Evers had to go to join David, and that left the house in Treme, Belle Reve, open for people to rent. So it really became a flop house. If friends didn't have a lot of money, they could stay there. And so there was like several people living there at one time. So you have this kind of communal atmosphere going on until 1973. And that's when Robert Laurent, again, who I feel is the mastermind behind this whole thing, said, oh, we love this Metassus Bar. Several friends had discovered Metassus Bar, which was next to their little grocery store. And it was just a hole in the wall, but it was very cheap booze. And they liked the atmosphere there. It was very decadent, you know. And So they decided, so the invitation went out for Southern Decadence again. And the reason it's on Sunday is because they felt that they could drink and get really drunk and have fun, and then they had Monday to recover. So it's always about recovery time. So he said, well, let's get in costume. What do you guys think about getting in costume and going to the bar, and then let's all walk back to Belle Reve and have our party? So they started doing that, and that was a big success. And I don't think there were a lot of drag queens at this point. They were still just kind of, and here's the kind of fun thing. Even the straight men in the group would like just put on a dress and just kind of walk around, just in any kind of costume. So it was all about costume. So 1974, when the invitations went out for Southern Decadence, Frederick Wright, this friend of theirs, whom they all adored, was named Grand Marshal. Well, this was news to Frederick Wright. He said, oh my God, what is this Grand Marshal? I don't know what this is. So they said, well, you're the guy. You're going to lead the parade and everything. So he took this and just ran with it, with costume, and you have to have the whistle. That's the start of the whistle blowing to start the Decadence parade. And, you know, each year a new Grand Marshal would be chosen. And probably by 74, 75, David Randolph sold Belle Reve. So that was out. That was no longer the destination. And the party became the parade. So they would meet at Matassa's and then just do bar hopping for the rest of the day. And by that time, 75, both Fred Wright and Jerome, Miss Pickle, was the Grand Marshal in 75. There were a lot of drag queens associated with Southern Decadence. So, and again, the Grand Marshal determined the route that would be taken, you know, which bars to visit throughout the day.
Yeah, that was something that I enjoyed as you were talking about costuming and all that, because as you know, I'm really interested in the material culture of celebrations. Mm-hmm. So this idea of the costumes and clothes as a form of defiance, there are a couple of examples that I found really interesting. First is that, of course, except for Fat Tuesday or Shrove Tuesday, it was illegal, right, to appear in drag in the streets of New Orleans by that time. And I learned here that the first Grand Marshal was a Black gay man parading as Uncle Sam, that I loved. And well, yes. But a side note, I love that invitation. And I'll try to add it to the blog post so that folks can see it as well. I'll ask
The invitation. Yes. The invitations, we're very lucky that Robert and his friends saved all of these invitations. They're just incredible documents, just how this whole thing came about and what the people saw. I mean, it's a way to get people excited. These invitations were so camp and so fun. For example, Miss Pickle's invitation was Chris Owens, who is a Bourbon Street entertainer, was standing on top of the Superdome. That was the year the Superdome opened. So she's like a burlesque Godzilla on top of the Superdome. That was the invitation. But then Jerome said, oh, well, I've got to go in drag as Chris Owens. So he was Chris Owens in drag as the Grand Marshal. But from our perspective, it's just, you don't get the impact, like you were saying. Like, this was daring to be out in the streets in drag during the day. Mm-hmm. And it's not Mardi Gras. You're not in drag performing at a bar, which, you know, that's pretty okay. You know, you could get away with it. There were drag bars. That was entertainment. But this was like transgression in the street, visible mm-hmm. to the public. So the police didn't know what to think of this. I think they were just shocked. So they didn't do anything. But this was like, this was breaking, chipping away at this Jim Crow, immoral presentation, your gender presentation in public. This was chipping away at it because straight men were wearing dresses and one guy went as Indira Gandhi. I mean, it's just so camp, so fun. They were having fun. They knew it was fun.
Mm-hmm. But not everybody was on board, right? In 1977, the religious conservatives already started protesting. How was that?
Well, you know, they kept going. They just kept going. I think anytime you're visible like that, transgressive visibility, you're going to have the religious right coming out for you. So mm-hmm. I think it wasn't coordinated. It wasn't powerful enough to do anything at that time. But yeah, I think because this was just
right? It's already as early as 1977, folks are already starting to complain
about 77 was, was Anita Bryant. There was a big backlash. So anything like that. So I'm just thinking that since this was such a, this was not an easy target. The Southern Decadence walking parade at this time was not an easy target because the route was always different.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, they didn't really know where the parade was going to be. So it was really hard to coordinate a lot of people to protest. So that was the strength of this kind of guerrilla parading at this point. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. So you talk then about the process of the gaying of decadence, and you have here 1980 as an important turning point. The original founders start withdrawing from the organization, and they're being replaced by this rising gay and lesbian community. How did that happen? And I'm interested in learning a little bit more about how drag becomes central to the parade's identity.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I've been thinking about this. I was especially interested in why gay visibility was so was really powerful during the 80s. And I think the Southern Decadence had something to do with it. I think that really spurred a lot of people who off and on participated in Southern Decadence to come out of the closet and be more visible during the year. So let's look at 1980. 1980 was huge for Southern Decadence. I don't have the official number for the participants, but it was hundreds. People got the invitation, they invited their friends. So it had really built up this momentum. Tom Tippin was the Grand Marshal. He's the brother of Maureen Block. And he's straight, and he had a costume. He was the King of Id from the cartoon strip, and everyone met at Matassa's bar, and they were he was leading them around the French Quarter. They ended up at Jackson Square. Now, this is when part of the group wanted to go to Frenchman Street, and then part of the group wanted to go with the Grand Marshal to some of the Decatur Street bars, some of the strip bars. So there was a big fight, let's say. There was a big argument, and most of the people went to Frenchman Street, and the Grand Marshal was left kind of holding the bag. So it left a sour taste in their mouth. So the next year, they just didn't want to participate in Southern Decadence anymore. It's like that that whole energy had dissipated with the schism, let's say, in 1980. And some of the core people had moved uptown. Maureen had started teaching at Tulane. Robert Laurent had an accident, so he was in the hospital. It's like they couldn't participate it's almost by chance, fate decreed that they sort of focused more on their personal lives instead of so much energy to Southern Decadence. But one of the core people was gay, Robert King, and he frequented the Golden Lantern. Now, the Golden Lantern was the sort of the end point to decadence. There was a buffet. If you made it through the whole day for decadence, there was a buffet waiting at the Golden Lantern with more booze, right? So he talked to some of his friends at the Golden Lantern and said, you know, let's keep going with this. So the first couple of years in the 80s, it went back to being very small affair. Now, at the Golden Lantern, you had Blanche. You had Blanche, who was a bartender there. And he was a very interesting person. That's why I spent so much time interviewing him and kind of reconnecting with him. He had a drag group at the Golden Lantern called the Demented Women. And this wasn't a drag group that tried to do the female impersonation. You know, like, that's more, I want to be as perfect a woman, the illusion of a woman, as possible. This was what we call terror drag and gender fuck drag, where, you know, you dress up in combat boots and you have a ratchet wig and you have crazy makeup and you're fierce. You know, you're in people's faces and you do shows. And that's this kind of new trend of drag at the time. It's more of a personal statement instead of female impersonation. So this is this transition to what we see today, I feel, where the drag was, you know, you have this core sensibility and then you build on that. So with Blanche's influence at the Golden Lantern, and Metessa's bar had closed too in 1980, after 1980. So the Golden Lantern became the center of Southern decadence. Everyone met at the Golden Lantern, and this is where drag began to dominate. This is what I saw when I lived in New Orleans. Drag dominated Southern decadence. It wasn't that big again. So when you think about the first decade, it kept getting bigger. There's a lot of people at 1980. It got smaller. And then the momentum started to build again as a just really a gay, exclusively gay event.
Mm-hmm. People often refer to Southern decadence as the gay Mardi Gras, and you sort of started talking about that a while ago. But what is the relation between Southern decadence season and Mardi Gras season? Are the crews involved? And what would be the difference between Carnival and Southern decadence?
There have been grand marshals that were also involved in the gay crews. That's kind of the overlap. Especially when you get into the late 80s, I think there was more of an overlap with just people attending Southern decadence. I know one of the grand marshals, Michael Hickerson, in the mid 80s was heavily involved in gay crews. And he was a black man who tried to start a gay crew in the 80s. And he succeeded in the 90s, but he was involved with Amun-Ra. He was very important. So that's kind of the connection. But it's the other end of the calendar. A connection, there's a connection with traditional carnival, too, because there are walking clubs during the carnival season. And there's a long tradition of that. They're usually straight men, historically, that would walk with the parade, like with Comus or Rex. And then in the late 60s, early 70s, you had the Society of St. Anne, which was a mixed group. So this could have had an influence on Southern decadence, where in the Marigny, which is adjacent to the French Quarter, this walking parade of St. Anne would start on Mardi Gras Day, early Mardi Gras Day, and it would gain momentum as it moved toward Canal Street for the Rex Parade. And during AIDS, friends and loved ones who had died, their ashes would be then taken and scattered in the Mississippi River. So it was a ritualistic, it became a very ritual cleansing type healing walking parade. So the precedent of walking parade, nowadays, we have walking parades with women centered around the French Quarter. And there's a nice book, Downtown Mardi Gras, that focuses on these new walking clubs. So walking clubs were and are still very important for New Orleans celebrations. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry?
No, just as you were mentioning, right, that and you note here that the AIDS crisis hit just as Southern Decadence was becoming a more gay or queer-centric event. And this is something that you mention in both of your books, is how despite this devastation, the epidemic also brings community together. So how are these informal ways of organizing as a Mardi Gras crew or through Southern Decadence, how have they served as a means of community building and mutual aid?
Yeah, this is a really interesting point, because you have the crews the gay crews who are already organized in the 80s, and then you have the Southern Decadence event, which was really used to disseminate information, and it was part of healing the community. So the epidemic, even though it was devastating, there were these groups that were already in place to help raise money and combat AIDS really early on. So I think there's a really good precedent here, a really good area here for someone to do research to see how these groups affected the AIDS crisis in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. So the next important turning point that you signal here is 1997, is when, after 25 years of very spontaneous revelry, the organizers decide to officialize the event. Can you explain that shift?
Now, this is very interesting, and it's still controversial, because there are the Southern Decadence purists who want a grand marshal to just go bar hopping. That's the tradition. And believe me, these traditions in New Orleans are, sometimes they're sacrosanct. But what happened, what's starting to happen in the 90s is it's just getting too big. The parade is hundreds and thousands of people now. So in 97, the Grand Marshal was approached by Larry Bagnaris, who worked for the city, and sort of the unofficial gay liaison with the city officials, and said, you know, we've got to get ourselves together on this and get a permit where we can have the city acknowledge this as a real event, plus have the police to safeguard the event, and have, you know, services from the city like toilets and things like that, because it had really gotten big. So this was a really big deal. So the Grand Marshal, Miss Love, and Larry met with the mayor in the mayor's committee, and they succeeded in getting a permit. And that's where the event became more official. So that was a big turning point. So not everyone agreed with that. This was very tough to even get a consensus on this, but it did happen. And it, I think it really saved Decadence, because otherwise I think it would have just gotten out of control, and perhaps, you know, the police would have had to do something to keep order. So I'm thinking this was a really smart move. I really have to say this ensured the continuation of Southern Decadence.
Yeah, but the attacks from the religious groups also increased in that period, right? There were all these scandals going on. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, let me just mention that another factor in the 90s that that helped to explode Southern Decadence was the internet.
Yes.
Sometimes we don't think about how important this has been in disseminating all of this information. A key person, well, persons involved in Decadence were Rip and Marcia Naquin-Delane. Now, they published the Ambush magazine, which was a queer community magazine, very successful in New Orleans. They originally came from Baton Rouge, and they moved to New Orleans and started Ambush magazine. And early on, in the early 90s, I mean, the mid-90s, late 90s, they bought up all these dot-coms, like SouthernDecadence.com, New Orleans, GayNewOrleans.com, all these things, and put out information. So right away, when someone would search on Gay New Orleans, you would get the Southern Decadence Festival is coming up. So this really added to all these people that are coming to the city. So with this increase in visibility, I mean, it was just really a lot of people by the early 2000s. You have the religious right looking at decadence and trying to figure out how they can stop it, quite honestly. There was a religious figure on the West Bank in Marrero named Grant Storm. And quite honestly, I think he used this as a way for to get personal publicity in all of this, but he made it his, you know, his crusade to stop decadence. So in 2002, he got some of his churchgoers to protest Southern Decadence, you know, and to complain to the mayor and the city and things like that. Well, not much happened. In 2003, he decided to videotape some of the goings on in the French Quarter. And this was really interesting. He did videotape. He went into bars and videotaped some of the films that were shown there and presented this to the mayor. And he succeeded in getting a state representative, Martini was his name, to back him and say, oh, this is horrible. You know, and this representative, Martini, said, oh, New Orleans just is such a cesspit. It's immoral. They deserve all the murders and everything they get. So this is a huge reaction to Southern Decadence, but it was not successful. And I'll outline that here. So they go to the mayor and say, you know, we've got to shut this down. We've got to stop this. And the mayor said, you know, we have decadence under control. It's fine. And besides, it generates so much money for the city.
Yes.
We want to keep it. We are not getting rid of it. They weren't crazy. You know, they weren't fanatics about this. So what's interesting about...
I just love the fact that this pious man is going around in New Orleans and you know, corners and street corners and gay bars and basically filming amateur porn. So that was strange.
Well, you know, they did, he and his followers did do physical demonstrations in the French Quarter in 2003, mm-hmm. but the police kept everything under control. And Rip and Marcia, they knew what was going on and they, you know, they chimed into this to the mayor. They said, you know, we have out of towners that come in and they just go crazy. We can't help that, but our people here are solid. You know, we have no problems with them. So they formed a vigilante group of gay guys that would go around. They were in t-shirts. They were designated as a information group, and they would go around telling people, "Oh, Martini succeeded in getting the laws toughened for, you know, public sex, that type of thing."
Mm-hmm.
So this vigilante group would go around handing out handouts and telling people, you know, we can't do anything improper because, you know, there's consequences and just have a good time, that type of thing. So they also, when the protesters were walking through the streets of the French Quarter, Rip and Marcia had people strategically placed on balconies with glitter bags, and they would throw glitter on everyone. So again, it's this kind of camp solution to attack these protesters, which, you know, instead of violence, they used camp and satire and fun, you know, to dissipate all this hatred, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting. During my research, I have to point this out. I read a lot of letters to the editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper, and 99% of them were in support of decadence. These were people that lived in the French Quarter who were residents. And one letter in particular was so poignant. The letter stated, this past weekend, I couldn't believe the horrible sights, the immoral sights that I was seeing on Bourbon Street, you know. And, you know, you would think that they were talking about Southern decadence. It says, no, it wasn't Southern decadence. It was all of the women showing their breasts and men pulling their pants down on Bourbon Street, which happens almost every weekend. He said, mm-hmm. Why aren't you focusing on this, which happens all the time, instead of 2 or 3 days of the year when everyone knows that Southern decadence and gay men are acting decadently. So, you know, there's a hypocrisy, homophobia. They really called it out. So mm-hmm. the community supported Southern decadence too. So I really have to point that out, which, you know, enabled the mayor to just say, no, we have to, we want to keep this, but you know, it has to be with the permit and everything.
Yeah.
So the permit, I think, with this attack on the religious right, with the city involvement, helped to save Southern decadence.
Yeah. So the future of Southern decadence is, of course, uncertain, just as our future, everyone's future, is, right now. But what would you say is the role or the importance of Southern decadence today for the city of New Orleans?
Well, decadence is a way for the queer community in New Orleans to express itself. It is the gay Mardi Gras. In the absence of lesbian bars, there aren't any lesbian bars anymore, and there used to be a lot. Now the lesbians are participating in decadence with some of their own events. So I think that Southern decadence might be a destination for the lesbian community. It's already happening. There's like decadence, they're calling it. So I'm really excited about that. I think there was even a transgender grand marshal recently. So I think there's room for the transgender community. I think that it's a time for the city to focus on the queer community and to uplift the queer community. And for the queer community to celebrate all of its, you know, successes. So I hope it comes back strong. I don't see why it wouldn't. There's a lot of support with it. I think it's here to stay. I'm thinking it may morph and change into something a little different, though. It may not be as big, but still having these grand marshals and visibility in the community, I think.
So I will conclude this section of the interview with a question, well, a similar question as the one I concluded our previous interview, which is what was lost, right? Because we see a lot of gains with the mainstreaming of Southern decadence becoming such an important staple in the city's calendar. But what was lost when Southern decadence became mainstream?
Well, I think this sort of cutting edge avant-garde creative spark, the sort of underground, you know, what can I do that would be the most outrageous? It's definitely more homogenized. I mean, the costumes are, you know, they're more carnivalesque. I think maybe this creative spark, I think that's why some of the traditionalists like this sort of a more chaotic Southern decadence. Like, we don't really know where we're going to end up, which bar we're going to end up. And now there's the parade, which is always it's very well attended, but, you know, some people think that it's too formulaic. I'm being very critical. I think it's fantastic, but I think that maybe some of this if we can resurrect some of this cutting edge ideas for decanets, I think that would serve it well.
Well, before we go, can you tell us about your new upcoming book and when can we expect it? I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I'm very excited about this upcoming book. It's called A Sojourn in Paradise, Jack Robinson in 1950s New Orleans. When I was researching my carnival book, a major component of my research was the Jack Robinson archive in Memphis. And this was a photographer who lived in New Orleans in the late 40s, early 50s, was part of the underground artistic culture of that time, including the gay culture. I eventually moved to New York and became a fashion photographer, pretty well known at the time. And he retired, well, he came back to Memphis to help his mother. I think she was ill. But he gave up his big career working for Vogue and Diana Vreeland. And he started working in stained glass design. And all of these negatives and photographs that he took were sort of hidden away in his apartment in Memphis. But when he died, his employer, who became his executor, discovered all of these negatives, and especially the ones in New York, the fashion ones. And in his will, Jack Robinson asked him to publish the images and have exhibitions and so forth. Well, the New Orleans ones were sort of hidden away as well. And when those started coming to light, they really became a time capsule of that time period. So the book, very briefly, I wanted to show the photographs as best as possible, very high quality printing. So there's 100 plates to the book. But my publisher wanted me to expand the scope of the book and talk about the artistic community, the gay community at this time. There's really a really interesting brief time period in the early 50s when the artistic community flourished, the gay community flourished, and of course, this helped to found the gay cruise in the late 50s. So it's a very important snapshot of New Orleans gay culture, gay history, and the overall history in general, because there's a component of the art community at that time too, which, you know, I feel New Orleans has been overlooked. With especially the gay community, but with the artistic community. And hopefully this book will bring all of this information out on a national, international level and show New Orleans for what it is. It's very important culturally during this time.
Yes, I've been waiting for this book for a while now. And I hope I can come to, you know, if you do I was going to say a premiere, but, you know, a book event here in Memphis, I'll definitely be there.
Well, we are planning.
Yes.
We are planning at the archive, but of course it's postponed. I just wanted to.
Yes. Howard, thank you so much for coming back to the podcast. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I just spoke to Howard Philip Smith about his book, Southern Decadence in New Orleans. It was co-written with Frank Pettis and published by the Louisiana State University Press in 2018. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.